I had a telephone call a few weeks ago from Professor James Arnold, who is a distinguished member of the French department. And he told us about our guest. The minute I had the call, I realized that this was something one ought to take seriously, because at one time Jim and I served on a committee that evaluated young scholars for summer grants at the university, and he was about the toughest evaluator that we had, and so I knew that this must be an exceptional opportunity. Nikita Pokrovsky is a professor at Moscow State University. His field is philosophy, classical sociology, and social theory. He has especially concentrated in his work on social and political philosophy, with special emphasis on moral, ethical, and social questions. His first work was a book on Henry Thoreau that has been well reviewed throughout the world, and in some 20 Soviet publications, among other things. In addition, he's published works on Ralph Waldo Emerson, on early American philosophy, with volume one dealing with Puritanism, and on The Maze of Loneliness, an edited version with a lengthy introduction. Along with Professor Arnold, he this year has been at the National Humanities Center on a fellowship at the famous Triangle Research Park in North Carolina. Everybody will be glad to know, and especially if they had a bad day yesterday, that Professor Arnold tells me that beautiful as North Carolina is, when they crossed the mountains, Virginia was even more beautiful. So we ought to, as somebody in Japan once said, when a young man, when I was going on a trip, and he wanted to get a railroad ticket for me and was worried that I might disappear, he said, "Hang around, I'll be right back." And so I think the message was, hang around, Virginia, in case you have any thoughts of leaving after that comment by Professor Arnold. The topic that Professor Pokrovsky will examine is the structure of political thinking and political action in the Soviet Union. It's a great honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Professor Thompson. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be today with you, to be your guest on campus, since among several publications which you mentioned, Professor Thompson, there was one which had and has the direct relations to the University of Virginia. This is my paper on political and social philosophy of Thomas Jefferson, and that was actually the first paper which I published in the history of American political and social thought, somewhat maybe 20 years ago or so, 15 maybe, and since that time I became known at my university as Soviet Jeffersonian. And surprisingly enough, little by little, my personal political views, I would say, especially now in the time of change and turmoil in the Soviet Union, are more and more becoming Jeffersonian, I would say. And this is a kind of a very interesting and significant for me relationship between, let's say, purely historical interest, which was maybe not purely historical at that time, of stagnation in the Soviet Union, but a kind of a way of expressing your personal understanding of things through history, through historical analysis, now which I can express just openly in the presentations like this or in my lectures at the university and so forth. So in other words, I'm very, very pleased to be with you, to be on the campus of University of Virginia and on the land of Thomas Jefferson in general. Let me tell you something before I start talking about the subject of my talk. First of all, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a specialist in legal philosophy or whatsoever. My field is sociology, social philosophy, and I would like you to know that just from the beginning. But what I plan to cover in my presentation is the perception of an ordinary Soviet citizen like me, a university professor or an intellectual probably, perception of legal system and its development in the Soviet Union in certain areas like political action, political thinking, and its structure, the new developments in this area in the Soviet Union. In other words, to be precise, how do Soviet people perceive law and jurisprudence and legal system in the Soviet Union? What specific changes occur now in this very important sphere of social life and social thinking? Mm-hmm. This would be my main approach to the subject of our discussion. I suggest for you to focus our mutual attention on several points, and I would like to present them just from the beginning. First of all, I would like to discuss certain terms in Soviet political vocabulary, like what's that perestroika, what's that glasnost, what's that now in the Soviet Union, left, political right, what's that radical and radicalism and conservatism and conservative? So what's the contemporary connotations of these very important political terms in the Soviet Union? Then, if you don't mind, we can move to the problem of Gorbachev and his legal thinking. What about his legal mentality and socio-philosophical approach to the policy or the politics in the Soviet Union? Historical, personal, maybe theoretical. Then I would like to spend some time discussing the problem of the growth of political culture in the Soviet Union, which is essentially important for any discussion in our field. Then constitutional process and its achievements and gaps in the Soviet Union. Constitutional process, its achievements and gaps in the Soviet Union, including the problem of elections, the sessions of the Soviet Parliament, the Article 6 of the Soviet Constitution, and the role of the party, I mean the Communist Party and the multi-party system in the Soviet Union. And I would like to finish my presentation with the discussing of the problem of political and legal aspects of property rights and privatization of Soviet economy as from its legal perspective. So it's a lot, and I believe that you understand that I cannot cover all the subjects on equal level. So please feel free to ask me any questions, just stop me and ask questions, and if we can start a kind of a free discussion, it would be just perfect for me. I'm not a formal professor, so I like discussions, and probably I can learn more from your questions than you can learn from my answers, but we'll see anyway. First of all, I would like you to know that I'm not someone who believes that we have a lot of similarities between the Soviet society and American society, Soviet people and Americans. I understand this is a wonderful PR notion that Americans and Russians are all the same. They smile, they represent two big countries, you know, geographically enormous, huge countries, and we are so similar. I would say, speaking seriously, in my view, and after spending about, let's say, 20 years in American studies and being at least for the eighth time in the United States now, I would say we have more differences than similarities. And nothing bad in this. Sometimes differences put people together much better than the likeness of people. You know, it's in family life the same. It's among neighbors, among neighbor countries, and among nations. When we have two absolutely identical social bodies, I would say, there is nothing between them in common. I mean, they are similar, and there is maybe not so things that can keep them together. So, let me give you one very simple and funny example. 2 years ago, I was touring Minnesota and Minneapolis, in fact, with a series of lectures in the Soviet Union and American philosophy, a little bit of everything. And it happened that time that all the time I was interviewed by American mass media, newspapers, and the second, if not the first question which I was usually asked was what I specifically disliked in the United States. For some reason, Minnesotans wanted very much to know my negative appreciation of American life. I don't know why. After I was asked for the fourth time about this, I decided maybe it was good time to answer, you know, honestly what I specifically did not like in the United States. And it happened that time when I decided to be open and to escape diplomatic treating of this answer happened at the TV studio live show, a kind of a very pale replica of Phil Donahue show, like audience, moderator, and me answering questions. And I decided to pick up something really very insignificant in order to support this style of the show. Short question, short answer, like the shooting, exchange of shooting. And I said, oh yeah, there is something which I really do not like. This is American tradition of potlucks, dinners. potlucks, dinners. Since I can't, really, as a Russian, I cannot understand how people arrive with their own food to see other people, to some other house. And after having this food, if the food is not eaten, they even take this food back with them. Since, you know, this is something absolutely inappropriate for Russia, for the Soviet Union, exactly. So if we invite people, that means that we take care of everything, including, of course, the food. So, but you know what happened after that? This very, in my view, I'm so sorry, insignificant thing, which I, you know, prepared maybe for the live TV show, caused an enormous, huge, and absolutely terrible attack on the part of the audience. These wonderful people, let's say Phil Donahue of people sitting in the audience, attacked me saying, you know, Mr. Pokrovsky, it seems like you absolutely do not understand the sacred traditions of American society, which go back to the Puritan age of the beginning of the 17th century, and probably arrived to this country together with the Mayflower people and pilgrims and forefathers. And it was and one housewife after another took floor and just taught me what the potluck tradition meant for Americans. Well, somehow, by this time, I had already been an author of the book on the Puritans, so I knew a little bit about all that. I decided to, since it was a discussion was open, I decided to express my personal mind about saying, yes, but in Slavic tradition, I understand that your interpretation is just perfect. But please, just could you please listen to me for 1 minute at least. In Slavic tradition, we Slavs in ethnical, I would say perspective or retrospective, we always were surrounded with enemies, Slavs, with Tatars, with Turks, with some other invaders. And when a Slav invited someone to his house from the milieu, relatively hostile historical environment, I would say, the host guaranteed to all his guests what the shelter, physical shelter, I mean the protection, and the food which was not poisoned, because it was very often poisoned at that time. It was the means of getting rid of certain peoples, you know. And how can you guarantee the healthy, not poisoned food if it derives from different sources? This is another perspective, and I believe it's also correct, because this is an entirely different historical perspective. So, in other words, this is a very simple, insignificant. I am not sure that I really persuaded my listeners and participants of Phil Donahue's show, but. One very important thing really came to my mind since that in order to understand and to become closer to each other, I mean two nations, American and Soviet, we should be more serious and more knowledgeable about our differences, and trying to interpret a famous saying by Teilhard de Chardin, a famous French philosopher, I would say that the appreciation of difference is the shortest way for the close contact between people and nations. So, this is a kind of introduction which probably can give you some hint about the importance and significance of knowing more about the Soviet Union. First, try, I hope you'll try to understand the Soviet Union and then make any judgments about its political system, its contemporary political developments, or whatever. First of all, let me talk a little bit about these very popular terms, perestroika, which now is an English term, and glasnost, which is also widely used by American press. And give a very short vocabulary of Russian political and legal language today. First of all, perestroika and glasnost. Perestroika in its direct translation into English and its explanation in English would mean the restructuring of the entire society. Historically, this term appeared in the second half of the 18th century. 19th century. In the 19th century, in the writings of Russian sociologists, in the time of the first reforms of Alexander II, including its legal reform, like perestroika of the whole Russian society of that time. Later, this term was picked up by Lenin who used it in some of his political speeches after the revolution. Then it was forgotten. And some, I guess, of Gorbachev's advisors or aides suggested him to use this term somewhat at the beginning of the year 1985, after he came to power, to use this term and to make this term a kind of a key password for the new political thinking in the Soviet Union. The same history, almost the same history, can be applied to the term glasnost. This is a Slavic word. Both of them are Slavic. No, they don't have any foreign roots. I mean, these two terms, they are entirely Russian. So glasnost means openness, and it can be applied to different circumstances and situations, not necessarily political, but also, let's say, family. Glasnost means kind of openness inside the family in discussing certain sharp issues. Glasnost at the university means the open way of dealing with some complicated intrigues in the university, which we all have, I guess. So what do I think about these words in particular? I'm someone among those who think that probably we'd better move to the usage of different terms. Why it's so? Because I think that instead of using this very vague term perestroika, which appeals only to the historical consciousness of Russians, we'd better use the term reform, or radical reform, or radical reformation of Russian society, which is the widespread international term for what's happening now in the Soviet Union. The same idea I have about the term glasnost. Since in Gorbachev thinking, I assume, glasnost is not exactly what one may call the freedom of press, freedom of expression, and freedom of consciousness. But I would like to equate glasnost to all these three international concepts, concepts like this. So in other words, I think that certainly we have to use this vocabulary because it's existing, it's widely used by everybody now in the Soviet Union, but in a long run, I guess, we'll change these words for this international set of terms. And this change of terms will indicate the change of political thinking as well. Because, again and again, I think that Gorbachev, talking about perestroika, somehow thinks this is not exactly the radical reform, but something specifically Russian perestroika. Well, it has a lot of similarities with reforms in different other countries, but nevertheless, it has its own peculiarities, and this position has its negative and positive aspects. We can talk about this. The same thing is important to talk about left and right in the Soviet political on the Soviet political stage. Now, what's that left and right? When in my talk I will use the word left, that means left more private property oriented, the free market economy oriented, more radical changes in this direction. That means left in the Soviet Union, which is absolutely opposite to what left means in this country. So I will try as I can to avoid these terms, but maybe somebody else to whom you will be listening next time, or listening to Radio Moscow, or reading some Soviet publications, will use these terms. So I would like you to be quite aware about its actual meaning. The rite means, the term rite has two different connotations, political, legal connotations. First, rite means nationalistically oriented, which is associated now with this movement called memory or Pamyat movement. This is obviously is used as right. Another aspect or another connotation of this right term would be something related to old guard thinking, like, in other words, socialism without change, communism ideology without change, Marxism, Leninism without any changes, good old times, Stalinist, more Stalinist-oriented thinking. That would be also right, and we have a lot of representatives of this thinking. In certain way, this first meaning of right and the second meaning of right are interrelated, because people from this nationalistic movement sometimes find a very nice common language with people from the old guard movement and old guard bureaucratic structures. But this is something for our further discussion. Radical and conservative. This is also a pair of very tricky terms which I would like to comment very briefly. Radical, usually applied to, well, obviously, you know, of course, even better than I do, radical to radical, maybe even revolutionary changes in the society. It is used both for describing left-wing opposition to Gorbachev, which is private property, free market economy. When people like Yeltsin, who is quite known here in this country, and some other people, call for the overnight changes of the Soviet in the Soviet economy, a kind of a shock therapy in Soviet economy, including the legal therapy, a shock therapy. They changed the whole set of laws and constitution in almost overnight. This is called radical. But we also have radical nationalists in the Soviet Union, radical nationalists. But radical nationalism is very similar to radical conservatism. They think that we should radically get rid of Jews in the Soviet Union, of some national minorities, that we should establish the national quota regulation of Soviet legal structures, and to establish quotas for different nationalities in Russia, which doesn't exist.
What do you think we do with the rest of it?
Pardon me?
What should be done with the ones that don't fit into the quota, the surplus?
What can be done with these people who fit the quota?
If they don't fit into the quota, what if you have too many Jews somewhere, then what do you do with them?
Well, different things can be done, but I'm not someone who is a outspeaker of this group, obviously, but I can guess what they said. By the way, they published their electoral program and platform two months ago. They do not discuss these problems openly, of course, in this publicly published platform, but the idea is to somehow to push off all national minorities from basic Russian legal systems, and to give room for ethnic Russians in these legal bodies, including the court, the government, the universities, for instance, to many other things. So they all also are radicals, but they are nationalistically oriented radicals. The only group to which I would hesitate to apply the word radical now in the Soviet Union would be the bureaucratic, old guard-oriented political groups. They are not certainly radical. So you see that there are a lot of different orientations in the political spectrum in the Soviet Union, and only one part of the spectrum, which is the old guard Stalinist-oriented spectrum, cannot be characterized as radical. In other words, the level of radicalism and political radicalism in the country is extremely high. The country is really in turmoil, and the combination and fight and struggle of different political views. And the more people and parties and groups are involved in this fight and struggle, political struggle, the more they are radicalized. And we all should be quite aware about this. Let me now talk a little bit about Gorbachev and his legal thinking and his personality. I know he's extremely popular in the United States, and people usually say that he could easily win the presidency here in the United States, which I doubt he can do in the Soviet Union, direct national referendum. But somehow he's a man of decade, and at least the Time magazine thinks so. So we should take him very seriously indeed. First of all, I'm usually not very happy when people say that Gorbachev's perestroika, or he's the designer of perestroika, or he's the new charismatic leader in the Soviet Union, Why so? Because we Russians, you know, we had so many charismatic leaders. Even me, I was born when Stalin was alive. I was on. Well, he died when I was 2 years old, actually. But nevertheless, you know, this entire atmosphere was Stalinized, I would say, even when I was, a young kid. Then Khrushchev came, and very soon after, a very wonderful democratic leader, who denounced Stalinism and Stalin oppressions and who was very democratic, he became very soon a new charismatic leader with absolutely no opposition, counterparts, but a new wonderful leader of the country with absolutely no substitution and stuff like that. Then, actually, my formatting years coincided with Brezhnev, and I am a product of Brezhnev stagnation, I would say, since I finished school, and I went to one of the same school with Brezhnev's granddaughter in Moscow. So even indirectly, I was a product of that time. That I entered the University of Moscow, and I graduated from the university during Brezhnev, and I became a professor. Well, I did not at all associate myself with him. My family, and including me, we all were very liberal thinking people. But nevertheless, we had to deal with this somehow. We could not express openly our dissatisfaction with that. So then came, after Brezhnev, Andropov for a very short time. There was a new charismatic leader, then Chernenko, and finally Gorbachev, who was very democratic at the beginning, and now we see the growth of his presidential authority and this tremendous excitement about him everywhere in the world, probably except the Soviet Union. So I would like to be very objective about him. And I would say that I appreciate very much what he did for my country, for the Soviet Union. He was really a very courageous and serious politician. He did very serious, important radical changes in the mentality of the Soviet mentality. He brought new generation of politicians to the Soviet Union, or in a certain way, he radically changed the mentality of the old politicians too. So his cabinet, or broadly speaking, his circle, is composed now of people from two different sources: people, the new people, and old people. I have certain observations of some of his favorite aides and advisors. Some of them, I used to know some of them very well. But nevertheless, they are new people, and they seem to think differently to what they were thinking before. Well, at least in the boundaries to which people can really change their views radically. So that's one point. But the other point is that I doubt seriously about the depthness of his legal thinking. He graduated from my university, or from the University of Moscow, with the, his degree in law and jurisprudence. And but let us think about what time of his graduation was that? The year 1955? He was the product of the Stalinist jurisprudence, in fact. And what's the law and constitution under Stalin? There was just nothing more than just paper. Just paper. It was a kind of an ornamentation of social political system. Ornamentation. It was just frames, you know, without any picture in it, just frames. And he was, you know, frankly, well, obviously, and evidently, he was the product of this epoch. And his political and legal thinking was formatted during his political career in Northern Caucasus region, when where he was really the boss, first the Young Communist League boss, then the party, Communist Party boss in Stavropolsky region. And he was really like the governor of this place, a small dictator. You know, I spent 2 years in Stavropolsky region during summertime as a sociologist. I never met Gorbachev, but I was there during the time when he was in charge of the whole area. It was, no, people were very much excited about him. But I'm not talking about his personal attraction, I mean, and his, but I'm talking about his mentality. So I think that he really has some problems now in thinking about the Soviet Union as a new constitutional legal state. Although he talks a lot about this, saying that we should establish the new legal system, legal thinking in the Soviet Union. But this is one thing to talk about this, and quite another thing to have it, like, you know, under your skin. Is it the correct English term?
Yeah.
Good.
Is it coincidence that one of his colleagues during his university days was Zdeněk Mlynář, a well-known Czech communist who became a dissident, who is now teaching at the University of Vienna? Is it possible that there was liberal thinking at that time, but under the system there was an inability to express it? The way to get up was to stay in line till you got there, then start pressing for your system or what you think should be done.
I don't know what about your source of information about this, but my source is Vanity Fair magazine, American Vanity Fair, which I read an article on Gorbachev there, and it just mentioned the author that he was very close to Mlynář during his, maybe it's quite possible. You know what? I can just imagine. I remember very well these years, 1955, 1956, the first Moscow Youth Festival, which opened the doors of the Soviet Union to foreigners. Actually, it was the first serious break through the Iron Curtain. I was 6 years old at that time, and I prepared certain flowers for the foreigners. You know, I remember. So I seriously doubt that Gorbachev could be liberal at that time. It was if he was thinking about his political career, any even hint or thought about political career meant at that time you should be either, you know, to the right from the center, at least. To the right from the center, you should be very conservative Marxist, you should be a very conservative politician. This was the only possible way to climb the social ladder in your political career. No way to do it somehow differently. No oppositional groups, no even undercurrents, liberal undercurrents in the Soviet Union. Can you imagine that? No, I cannot, but it was, you know, this way. So I'm trying to figure out his political evolution as a political leader. So, in other words, I would say, watching now his behavior as the chairman of the Soviet of the meetings of the Soviet Parliament, sessions of the Soviet, it's called the Congress of People's Deputies, to be precise in my terminology. Watching his way of handling the meetings of different people, especially of the parliamentary constitutional convents in the Soviet Union, I can trace in his speech, in his behavior, in his conduct, different ingredients. The ingredient of his party career, like everything, can be handled very easily. It's very easy to shut up people, just saying, it's your time is over, just leave the podium, that's okay. You are not important, just give floor to somebody else. Sometimes I can trace his attempts to become a kind of a respectable Western politician and parliamentary leader, and using the technique of handling, legal way of handling the sessions like this. So he's a little bit of everything. It makes me really very happy, because he's on the run, he's in transition, he's in the search of his new image, he's very flexible. But flexibility, as you probably know, also has positive as negative aspects, of course. So I try to be objective and in the same time sympathetic. I'm sorry, you have a...
I think I hear you saying that Mr. Gorbachev has created something that he's now very uncomfortable with.
He's not very uncomfortable with?
That he is uncomfortable with.
He's created something that he's...
Don't we create our children with whom we're uncomfortable
yeah.
with?
Not all of them.
Not all of them, yeah. And I think that it's wonderful if we are at a certain point uncomfortable with our children, right? Because this is a way to have a kind of a personal progress, family progress, in order to adjust.
But will it get beyond him to the point where he cannot carry out what he has in mind?
There is a theory in the Soviet Union, or at least a point of view, that Gorbachev is now is a little bit inappropriate to the new stage of the radical changes in the Soviet Union, that his personal radicalism doesn't fit the political spectrum or political main political objectives of the society, that his personal, let's say, educational background is not sufficient for handling the country on a new stage. This opinion is expressed in the parliament, especially if you had the chance to walk through the pages of the records of the last session of the Soviet Parliament in February. You could just read this. Well, please don't ask me to make my personal appreciation. Maybe, but again, I say he's very flexible, he's relatively young, and at least not old. And I guess he has a talent or capability to learn. This is a wonderful capability to learn during your entire life, but not only during your formative years. He has this capability.
But will he understand that he needs to go farther than he has?
I don't think that he thinks this way, but I know that the development of the processes in the Soviet Union will force him to think so. And if he wants to survive as a politician. And this is the wonderful dialectics of this political survival, which you should contribute to the political processes or the process in the society in order to support your personal survival. either you feed this process, either you handle this process, or the process will overcome you very, very easily. So this is a very tricky, well, this is, you probably know, it's here at the Miller Center, which is the power of presidency, which is exactly the same. This is the philosophy. So I wanted just to give you certain approaches and certain hints about Gorbachev. He's contradictive, as we all are. He's very dynamic, which we not all are, but he is, and that's wonderful. He's flexible. He's a good speaker, although his Russian is not perfect, but he can speak without reading the papers, you know, like no one before him. His predecessors could not do this, so he can. This is a big progress, so his mentality is very dynamic again. So that's wonderful, and I'm not going to make any predictions dealing with his future, because we'll see, and this is the most wonderful. If he's skillful enough, wise, shrewd, he will survive, certainly, as a radical politician. If he becomes more conservative, so that would be, I guess, the dead end in his personal career. That's my very vague prediction. We'll see anyway. But by all means, he will stay in the history of the humankind as a very important politician. I think we can spend about 45 minutes, okay? If it's all right with you, with your schedule. Good. What about the growth of political culture in the Soviet Union? You know, this is the most painful, to me at least, for me, most painful problem, since we can talk about the new laws, the new constitution, the new parliament, the new legislative system, but if we lack the legal or political culture in the country, if people do not realize what's there to be a subject of law and what's there to have the law higher than anything else in the country, higher than any charismatic leader, and when leaders of the country do not understand this, like they should pray for laws, not for their personal careers. That's what political culture is, briefly speaking and roughly speaking. We're not going to have anything serious in the Soviet Union. But political culture is something like, you know, growing a garden, planting a garden. It cannot appear in 2 days, in 3 days. With one possible exception, I would say, and that's why a good chance to recall Jefferson again and democratic approach to that. In many of Jefferson's writings, especially from the year 1776 up to the year of the adoption of the American Constitution, we can find a lot of ideas of Jefferson dealing with the problem that democracy and constitutional thinking, democratic thinking, does not involve, let's say, long process of generating. It's something which is so natural for human soul or human nature or human personality, like the fresh air and the breathing. Of course, there are different techniques of breathing, like Indian yogi system, you know. But nevertheless, we can all breathe without even the systems. And we know what's that when we have fresh air, or even air-conditioned air, you know, that's wonderful. This was Jeffersonian approach. So let people have a democratic system. Give them this system. And the next day, they will grow this technique of democratic thinking and behavior, because democracy is a part of human nature. It's an inalienable right and an inalienable aspect of human nature, eternal. But that's how I understand Jefferson. And I would say the same with political culture in the Soviet Union. We can talk about the generational gaps in understanding legal system and legitimacy in the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, I think that the radical changes of the constitution, of political system, will facilitate enormously the process of adopting this constitutional ideals and going them up somewhere under our skin, right? Yeah. Rather than in our heads, in our hands. So what's after discussing this, you know, wonderful models and ideals, let's get closer to earth, down to earth, and discuss certain problems of that. So on the one hand, now we have in the Soviet Union the first Congress, or let's say parliament, use this term, parliament, elected on a multi-not-party system, but elected on in the condition of the competition of different candidates for this parliament. I'm not going to give you a precise analysis of how it happened in reality, but to give you certain hints from the standpoint of a regular Soviet citizen who is concerned about all these things. First of all, I would say this was wonderful. I took part in these elections. I'm a Moscow resident. I live in Moscow. We have two candidates for one position, one place in the parliament from Moscow. The whole city, it's about 9 million people now. 9 million people, two candidates. One of them was conservative, more or less, in terms of his old guard orientation. And, well, I wouldn't say Stalinist. I'm not going to insult this person, but let's say old guard, old Marxist orientation person who was the, and who is a director of a huge automobile plant in Moscow, something equal to General Motors in Detroit. Plant truck and cars and even refrigerators. This is the largest industrial body in Moscow. This director was nominated or elected to be a candidate for the parliament. And his rival was Yeltsin, the former party boss in Moscow and the obvious critique of Gorbachev. And I voted for Yeltsin, and Yeltsin somehow got 85% of votes, of ballots, I mean, of secret ballots. And he was elected, and he received, as he says, and it's true, the mandate of all Muscovites. And this is true. This is true. You cannot argue with statistics. It is true. This is true. So, but this is just one example, important example. But it's not sufficient in discussing the parliament itself. It was composed of three platforms or three sources. First, this is direct elections, like the elections which took place in Moscow and all over the Soviet Union. People elected in direct competitive elections constitute maybe one half of the parliament. One half, 50% of seats in the parliament. The other half is divided into two equal parts. People elected by public organizations. People elected by public organizations and people elected from the Communist Party, from the Communist Party and some other organizations. So what does it mean in reality? And what did it meant in reality? That meant that many of these people, frankly speaking, were just nominated. I took part in other elections. I am a member of the board of Soviet Children's Fund, which is the second largest public foundation in the Soviet Union, multi-million foundation in the Soviet Union. And Children's Fund had several seats in the parliament reserved just for this foundation. And we elected several people to be deputies equal to Yeltsin, I mean, in their legal status. But they were just, you know, it was like a very intimate way, just they all these people were just discussed very briefly by the members of the board, and we voted for them. So me, I had two votes. Some people had four votes. For instance, my parents, they are members of some other public organizations. They voted four times. Some people just one time, like regular citizens. Can you imagine this mixture of everything? Now we have a parliament, and it composed on very people who passed through this tremendously difficult procedure of the direct vote with electoral meetings, discussions, and rallies, public rallies, TV shows, and some people who were elected in the rooms like this, you know, like by the number of people, like people who are gathering here. And people elected are also the equal members of the parliament.
May I ask you, the yes. people who were in the half of the parliament that was elected by direct vote, as you said, in Moscow, only one person represented 9 million people. There was no proportional representation. That half of the parliament, does it have proportional representation?
You know, I made my picture a little bit, I simplified the picture. Of course, I voted not only for Yeltsin. I voted for Yeltsin as a representative of the national district, electoral district, but I also voted for some people who were elected from the territorial districts. Well, it's very common. So Yeltsin was elected by Moscow as a representative of Russian nationality based in Moscow. Moscow is predominantly Russian area. So, but I voted for several other members of the parliament, I mean, in Moscow, who represented Moscow as the territorial district. Moscow had about 15, I believe, 15 members of the parliament were elected from a smaller districts in Moscow. Moscow was divided into 15 areas, 15 districts. Electoral districts, in one big district, I mean national district, like Russian Moscow in general. Well, you know, if you need all these details, we can talk about this. This it will really lead us to the depths of Soviet very complicated system. And the one of the reasons of this complexity, I would say, is the lack of clarity about what how it could be done. Gorbachev and his design of all this was a kind of a transitional model, because he did not want it to upset old guards and bureaucrats and apparatus. And that's why I believe, again, he reserved certain almost guaranteed positions for them, basically from the public organizations. If you make a sociological analysis of the membership in the Soviet parliament now, you will see that the most of the so-called politicians, even very articulate, well-known politicians who were more or less associated with the previous political system, pre-Gorbachev or early Gorbachev era political apparatus, they got into a parliament through this so-called public organization entrance. And from another entrance, the entrance of competitive elections, got the politicians now who either constitute the his opposition to Gorbachev, or represent some national minorities in the Soviet Union, or whatsoever. So the structure of the parliament is very complicated now. What are people now talking about in Moscow? That we should abolish this complicated system of electing the Soviet parliament. All elections should be direct, competitive, with absolutely no predominant advantages for any public organizations. And I guess this Gorbachev is now inclined to this decision. First of all, because the elections on the level of national republics for national parliaments and the city parliaments, which are just on the run now in the Soviet Union. You know, yesterday was a story in the New York Times, in the New York Times and stuff like that. So they do not have these reserved seats for public organizations. They are differently handled. But in general, the structure of the constitutional parliamentary system is such that the highest body, which is the Soviet parliament now in general, is more conservative than the parliaments of national republic parliaments, local parliaments, and city parliaments. So we have the kind of a radical change and radical support for the changes going from beneath or from below rather than from the top parliament. But one very important role of the first parliament, I would say, should be mentioned very directly, and the parliament gave rise to the new generations of politicians. And in this way, he supported the growth of political culture in the Soviet Union. If you watched the debates in the parliament, they were terrible, I would say. They showed just the absolute lack of, traditional parliamentary culture in the country, on the part of the podium, on the part of the chairman, on the part of the people sitting in the hall. I mean, in the auditorium, on both parts, on all three parts. But on the that's true. It was a kind of a gathering of people, irritated, wanting, shouting. Trying to discuss their personal problems rather than, the problems of their very small regions rather than talking about the problems of the country in general. So it was a mixture of everything. But it was wonderful in a way. This direct live TV broadcast from of the parliament session just kept the whole country at TVs, and the productivity of the national economy fell tremendously during the time of the broadcast from the Kremlin. You know, that's also statistics. We cannot argue with it. So that's another. I just noticed an interesting book in your study, Professor Thompson, dealing with the role of the TV broadcast on the parliamentary and congressional sessions. This is tremendously important for this. And that was one of the most serious achievements of Gorbachev and of openness. I'm not using the word glassness, but the openness and the freedom of speech and freedom of expression in the Soviet Union. The whole country watched that. And it influenced enormously the growth of political culture in the country. So, but the main achievement of the first session and the second session of the Soviet Parliament was that it gave rise to the new generation of politicians. Nice, usually young people, very often with a very good professional educational background, like lawyers, professors, sometimes people representing national minorities, with wonderful logical system of thinking. You know, this is quite a wonderful pleasure to listen to someone who handles logic very well. You know, and is a moral person at the same time. The combination of logic and morality is wonderful. And I was really inspired by many of the deputies of the parliament who were very articulate, very logical, in their thinking, political thinking. At the same time, really moral people and very good speakers as well, who spoke very good spoken Russian, I mean, colloquial Russian and literary Russian, because it was, you know, believe me or not, for decades it was just a torture to listen to Soviet politicians, because the way they handled Russian, the Russian language, it was just everything opposite to what I was taught at school or at the university. And now it's different. And the language is also a very important part of political culture, political language, a political lexicon or a political vocabulary, whatever you use, terminology. It's a very good indication, in my view, indication of the rise of the growth of political culture. Yes, I see. I understand. Okay, I'm probably I really have some problems with my logic. So maybe 10 more minutes.
Yeah,
just 10. Let me tell you just very briefly. A story dealing with two Soviet lawyers who are now the focus of the turmoil and political controversy in the country. I'm talking about two Soviet lawyers who both are members of the parliament and who worked for many years for the office of the general prosecutor in the Soviet Union. Prosecute, okay. Well, I would say...
Freudian slip.
Yeah, that's a very symptomatic slip of the tongue, right? Well, usually prosecutors are persecutors, but, well, it depends, of course. So, prosecutor, and their names are Gdlian, it's G-D-L-I-A-N, it's Armenian, he's an Armenian, and Ivanov, which is a very popular Russian name, very popular. They both they belong to one and the same group of prosecutors who were nominated to investigate the cases of corruption in Central Asia, in Central Uzbekistan, dealing with this illegal trade of cotton, and a lot of other violations. So they were investigating these cases for 5 years, and finally they found out such enormous, huge violations, which resulted in multi-million violations of financial rules and multi-million capitals gathered by illegally in these republics. And but the most important thing was that little by little they opened the direct relations between the Central Asian mafiosi people. Oh yeah, by the way, the term mafia, this Italian / American term, is one of the most widely used terms in the Soviet political lexicon now. You know, I have a problem with this. Just 2 years ago, did they tell you? No. At the top of the World Trade Center in New York, they have a small store, just a kind of a store, and I bought a parking sign there. Mafia cars only, others will be towed. Like, you know, standard white and red parking sign. And I have brought this sign with me to my apartment in Moscow, and I hang this sign on the wall of my room. And you know what? So my Russian friends and visitors are just happy about seeing them. They laugh. They say how it's wonderful, and they start asking me a lot of questions, and saying it would be very nice to bring this traffic sign and parking sign to Central Asia or even in Moscow, they gave me some advices where it would be quite appropriate to install this. But you know, the reaction of American visitors and my American friends, they are terrified when they see. They take this sign very seriously, usually, and they ask, what does it mean, Nikita? Basically, I would say sociologically and socio-psychologically, they do not like the sign in my room in Moscow. It's up to you to decide why. But they investigated that certain relations between the Central Asian mafia and corrupted levels of the Central Asian economic circles go directly to Moscow. And to very high-ranking Soviet politicians who are still active on contemporary Soviet political arena. And that caused enormous problems and enormous controversy. Both Ivanov was elected like Yeltsin from Leningrad, even though Ivanov is not a resident of Leningrad. Can you imagine that? That someone would be elected from New York to American Congress being not a New York resident. Well, it happened, I guess, certain things like this before. But this is, but it happened in the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, because people in Leningrad supported this investigation. After that, Ivanov received the parliamentary immunity. Immunity?
Yes.
Immunity. I'm learning my American legal language.
Exactly, it's parallel to the way Bobby Kennedy was elected senator
from New York.
He was not really a resident of New York, and he was also a famous prosecutor.
I see. Well, probably it happens from time to time with all prosecutors. Right? They need support from somewhere else rather than from their home cities. So, Glian was elected from Moscow, from one of smaller Moscow territorial districts. Now they are in the middle of this controversy. But the point is that people who try to blame them, try to put them in court for violating the code of investigation, saying that they violated certain very important rules of investigation, like they kept certain people in prison for a longer time than they were expected to do. And I believe they did. I believe they did this, that they promised some people like the release from the prison for the evidence they gave, You know, this is a very trivial, simple thing, like a trade. And I believe they did this. But nevertheless, they opened such things, and this is a very essential problem. Can the prosecution in general or legal representative or legal system can use illegal means for achieving, let's say, very honest legal purposes?
The same problem here.
Sure. So, and whatever would be the result of this case, I'm sure that at a certain point Parliament can, they both are expelled from the Communist Party, which is probably not so important for them right now because they are members of this inter-regional party group, which is, but they can be expelled from the parliament too, because the parliament is very conservative and it can vote for the abandoning of their immunity, parliamentary immunity. It can happen. So, but at least this case, which keeps the whole country, you know, very, very aware about all this, to keep this very enthusiastic about discussing these things, is a very important as an impetus for the growth of constitutional culture and constitutional and legal culture in the Soviet Union. Yes, I guess this is the point where I can finish.
Okay, questions, Bill?
Just one question. What do you visualize Lenin's position to be in Russian history if perestroika works?
So if Lenin is alive, what would...
No, no, no. Lenin, you see him in the assembly when they had their great meeting, the statue or picture of Lenin in the back wall. Will it still be there 20 years from now?
That's an interesting question indeed, because, you know, if we analyze the attitude of Gorbachev towards Marx and Lenin and the Marxist-Lenin's heritage, we see a very strong changes in his views. First of all, he was never a person who was very much excited, you know, classical Marxism itself, like Marx, Engels works. Even statistically and sociologically, you can find in no quotations from Marx in his public speeches. I guess maybe because he found Das Kapital a little bit more complicated for him to understand during his university years. Maybe. I don't know. You know, if you are sick and you miss some classes, there's no time to come back to this again. So, but he was very enthusiastic about Lenin saying, trying to just some, to, how do you say that, to wear the moccasins of Lenin, or walk the moccasins of Lenin, because Lenin was also very flexible, very pragmatic. In his political views, and especially with his new economic policy, which is called NEP, is abbreviation of this in Russian. So then an important case happened in Moscow. One of the members of the parliament, and actually the art director of one of the prominent Moscow theaters, who was recently in New York in Broadway with his musical play, on live show, on night live show, which is scheduled according to the polls to be the first at the top of the most popular shows, he just mentioned briefly it would be very nice to bury Lenin somewhere in the cemetery graveyard rather than to keep him in mausoleum. But a very simple thing, and you know, it was Stalin's idea to have Lenin, like cult of Lenin, to put him in an oriental way, in a mausoleum. You know, the word mausoleum is not the Russian word. So it was very, it was a huge attack on this person on the part of party officials, saying, "Well, you are just." It's something like I received with my potluck venture in Minneapolis. Like he was smashed and mashed in.
Bill Hartley.
I didn't finish that. I'm sorry, but now you know what Gorbachev doesn't cite Lenin very often. Lenin, because he's moving apart from Lenin's heritage since the abandonment of the Article 6 of the Constitution, dealing with the leading and predominant leadership of the Communist Party, goes entirely apart from the 10th Congress of Communist Party designed by Lenin and his idea that the Communist Party should be always, always, ever the leading force of the socialist society. So it's a certain trend and change, I would say, in his ideas.
Bill, yes. You mentioned the difference between the Slavic culture and the American culture. Is this not the basic problem right now with the different nationalities, the Slavyanskaya dusha coping with the
mysterious cultures, Russian soul, right?
Correct. Coping with the other nationalities.
We don't have many Americans living in the Soviet Union, so you. No, I understand. Of course, I understand it, sir.
The Muslims and the.
Is it a serious problem?
Yeah, well, it apparently is.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
But how are you going to cope with that?
Me personally, or the country in general?
I would say on a political level, I mean, are you going to create would you advise a commonwealth or what sort of federation? I mean, there seems to be a, certainly a, the different ethnic groups are bent on exercising their national sovereignty.
Yeah, well, the idea of the Commonwealth seems to be perfect for me. I don't think that anything can keep certain nationalities inside the Union, as a part of the Union, without certain changes in the status of their alliance to the Union. Because, neither force nor political statements or new president, the martial law or anything of that kind can stop for a long time the process of the obtaining of national identity and national liberation, which takes place, for instance, in Lithuania as the most culturally uplifted and elevated part of the Baltic republics. And because, by the way, the process of reaching or the national independence in Lithuania goes strictly in the constitutional framework as a part of the constitution, unlike the Azerbaijan and Central Asia, where people have a very, very slight idea what's the parliamentary and constitutional law is. I mean, how can it be handled? It's this more violent. So, in other words, to finish with this very complicated, I would say that we should certainly, in an ideal case, we should give them the right to secede from the Soviet Union, but I don't think we should curse them, saying, you know, yeah, you should leave and we do not want to hear of you anymore. But we if I were Gorbachev, I don't like this if clauses, but let's suppose for a second, I would say we should support your independence, even so, economically. For instance, Lithuanians have problems with their power supply and energy supply. So I would say, yeah, we'll support you even with energy, with raw materials, but still you would be independent, because helping people sometimes help you to keep control of them rather than to cursing them and saying, you know, you're terrible and I don't want to hear about you anymore. And this base of friendly support of independence of these national republics will become a base for the coming back on the level of Commonwealth, which I mentioned so wonderful. Since we cannot keep people saying that you are not mature to give your national independence. This is, you know, the entire history teaches something different.
We're way over the limit already, but four, five, six of you have asked for the floor. If you can ask your question in one sentence, we will succeed in covering all of you. Mm. Bill, you used to appear before the Supreme Court. Why don't you do it in one sentence?
On that same subject, do you think that the spread of contested, what did you call it, competitive elections nationwide and regional to the parliament will help or solve the problem of ethnic groups wanting to secede from the Soviet Union?
I would say that the idea of the direct, equal, and competitive vote for the parliament will, first of all, support the in a progressive way, will support the growth of democracy in the Soviet Union, in Jeffersonian meaning of this term. And as a part of this growth and expansion of expansion. Good. I tried to correct my English on that. So, expansion of the constitutional ideals in the Soviet Union. This will somehow put us closer to the solving of the problem of nationalities, in this new parliament, in the new. So, I mean, we should approach to this from different angles, from different directions, and we cannot solve one problem after another, which Gorbachev tries to do all the time, one after another. But we should, you know, do many things from different. If we really have a sick body, we need sometimes not to use different approaches of healing, but to use several of them in one time.
Professor Johnston.
Professor Thompson, may I make one brief sentence and then one brief question? It's an 18th century question, so it will be a rather long sentence, but I'll try to keep it to one. Professor Pokrovsky, you look to the left, there's another portrait of
Washington, yes.
Equal significance. May I just, as a quick footnote, suggest that the only thing that troubles me in a very brilliant presentation is a certain tendency to equate the higher law with democracy, which certainly our first president would never have done. There is an alternative tradition, little r Republican tradition, which is the basis of our higher law tradition, and democracy was only 1/6 of our government in 1789. So the Republican tradition, I think, is more closely linked to the higher law tradition than the Democratic tradition, and I think it would be interesting to chat about that briefly. But with regard to the best sources of information about changes in the Soviet Union, we're getting all sorts of material, Pravda International, the Literary Gazette, and many others. Which would you recommend that we read to get the most incisive understanding of developments in your country?
Well, I would recommend you, first of all, if you do not know Russian well enough to read fluently Russian press, I would recommend you, first of all, to read Moscow News in English. Moscow News, you can get a subscription for this newspaper in the United States. It's published also in Russian, and it's one of the most popular Russian newspapers now. Besides, I would recommend you to read the Literaturnaya Gazette, which you mentioned. And it's wonderful that it is now translated into English. I don't think that these, you know, newspapers are just excellent with no critical appreciation of them. No, there are certain things which I dislike or certain ideas, of course. But nevertheless, they are very well informed, and they can give you certain ideas about what's happening in the Soviet Union. There's two things which, if you want to know the official point of view, you can read Pravda, of course, because the editor-in-chief of Pravda, who is Frolov, is the closest confidant of Gorbachev. And so it's somehow the Pravda newspaper now is the pulpit of Gorbachev, I mean, his pulpit or his podium or something. So that's... If you can listen to Radio Moscow, well, specifically I don't like it. It's too sweet, you know, like sugar and no spicy stuff. But, you know, maybe.
One final question, Professor Fernbach, in one sentence.
If you go back to the political culture problem and think about democracy, do you not have to come to the point that the dignity of the individual as represented by equality before the law, mm-hmm. and therefore the power of the courts over other aspects of government,
yes.
is paramount to getting the concept of limited government that makes democracy work at the institutional level?
Yeah, I strongly support in this point of view, I would say. And I would say that it would be extremely helpful for Soviet politicians and legal persons to people to take this model and the dignity, yeah, and the dignity of people in is so important for the functioning of the law system without friction. I mean, or with at least with limited friction. And this is something, these parameters should be certainly taken into very, very serious consideration. And this is something, to finish, something which can be and should be borrowed from American system, borrowed and implanted in the Soviet Union.
The only person who is tougher than Professor Arnold on a committee is Professor Ben Bennett. He's so powerful on a committee that whatever the discipline presented, he's read more than the representatives of the discipline. And he's the other person that made this meeting possible this morning, and I wanted to thank him. But most of all, we want to thank you for
Professor Thompson, thank you very much. And I enjoyed very much being with you. And if I met at least some of your expectations, I would be just happy. Thank you.